From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
With our victory tonight in Wisconsin, we have now won 7 out of 8 of the last caucuses and primaries.
That was Senator Bernie Sanders Tuesday night as he claimed victory in Wisconsin's primary, his 7th victory out of the past 8 matchups against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
And we have won almost all of them with overwhelming landslide numbers. What momentum is about is that at a time in contemporary politics when every major candidate has a super PAC, we have said no to super PACs, said no to the billionaires who fund those super PACs. And what we have done is, in an unprecedented manner in American history, we have, up to this point in the campaign, received over 6 million individual campaign contributions. Anyone here know what the average contribution is? That's exactly right. Smart crowd. $27. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg, this is a campaign of the people, by the people, and for the people.
On the Republican side, Senator Ted Cruz was the big winner, and he set his sights on Hillary Clinton.
It was a bad night for Hillary Clinton. It was a bad night in the Democratic primary, and it was an even worse night for her in the Republican primary. We're winning because we're uniting the Republican Party. Of the 17 candidates who started this race, a terrific, talented, dynamic field, 5 have now endorsed this campaign. Rick Perry and Lindsey Graham and Jeb Bush and Carly Fiorina.
Cruz also tried to make the case that his campaign has momentum, although that stood on much shakier ground than Sanders' claim.
The national political terrain began to change 2 weeks ago. In the state of Utah, we won 69% of the vote, a landslide election. And just 3 days ago in Colorado, 2 congressional districts voted. Once again, they elected 6 delegates, and of those 6 delegates, we won all 6. And then 2 days ago in North Dakota, we had another tremendous win. They elected their delegates. Of the delegates who specified their support, 18 are supporting our campaign. 1 is supporting Donald Trump.
For more on what happened in Wisconsin and what it all might mean going forward, we spoke with Abiyomi Ezekwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, who this week wrote a piece analyzing the role of the African-American electorate from 1960 to 2016 and its significance within the broader context of the struggle for national liberation and social justice. The article appears at the website of the Montreal-based Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. We spoke with him via Skype from Detroit Wednesday. Abiyomi, welcome back. A pleasure as always.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So, very interesting analysis of the role of the black vote in American politics from, I guess it begins back in 1960 in your analysis that's at Global Research, and comes up to date. You want to take us through a little history?
Well, yes. The 1960 presidential elections represented a turning point from the standpoint that a lot of the focus in 1960 was still heavily oriented towards the Cold War. You had the 1950s, where the United States had intervened in Korea. They had also backed the continued French domination of South Vietnam. And they had been involved an enormous amount of subterfuge in regard to undermining national liberation movements throughout the world, including on the African continent. So in 1960, John F. Kennedy, who had been the initiator of the Senate Subcommittee on Africa, the first one during the late 1950s, in an effort to court the newly emerging African states, also had an interest in wooing particularly the African-American vote in the South. And there was a big struggle in 1960 that erupted, particularly in Southwest Tennessee and Fayette and Haywood counties, where African-Americans had been put off their land as tenant farmers, as sharecroppers, because they dared to register to vote in the 1960 elections. So a situation developed where Dr. King had been arrested in Georgia, and the Kennedy family had expressed their sympathy towards Dr. King. There had been a phone call to Dr. King's wife, Coretta Scott King, and this, of course, got national press coverage. But there were other issues as well. Kennedy made a special appeal to African Americans in 1960 to vote, and they got over 80% of the African American vote in 1960. Now, this is significant because in the South, the Democratic Party was heavily racist and pro-segregation. In 1948, there had been the Dixiecrat candidacy of Strom Thurmond, which rejected even a moderate, minimal program of civil rights, which had been put forward by the Truman administration, not because they wanted to improve the conditions of black people in the United States, but because they realized they were in an ideological struggle with the Soviet Union and the other emerging socialists and national liberation movements around the world. So, of course, in 1964, Johnson won by a landslide, and he had a solid support also of the African-American vote because Goldwater had said that the Civil Rights Bill was unconstitutional and had appealed to the worst racism still very much in evidence in 1964. Now, we could talk about the role of the black vote in the Obama campaign 8 years ago, his reelection in 2012. But what we have seen, though, which is quite interesting, is a further rightward shift in the U.S. Congress, where the Republicans dominate by substantial margins both houses of the U.S. Congress. So why is this? I tried to address the question of the fact that the Obama administration and other Democratic politicians do not address the specific concerns of African Americans, of Latinos, of women, of working class people, poor people in general. And this has resulted in many of them staying home during these by-elections or not even voting in the congressional or senatorial elections. So here we have 2016, where Hillary Clinton was being framed as someone who would be involved in more or less a coronation rather than an actual competition for the vote, now being given not only a run for the Democratic Party establishment's money, but also transforming how people look at these primary and caucus processes. And what we see is a shifting of opinion, particularly among African Americans and others, in away from the Clinton campaign towards Bernie Sanders. And I think that's very interesting because it illustrates a continuation of a degree of political independence.
You know, there's something interesting that I heard this morning listening to Brian Becker He was framing a question and used the fact that, you know, many people know now that Hillary Clinton was what was called a Goldwater girl, and laying out what Goldwater's program was towards the black community and tying that to the things that were done during the Clinton administration, particularly with the ending of welfare as we know it and other such programs.
Yes, and I remember very vividly that that statement about ending welfare as we know it eliminated any semblance of a social safety net for the poor inside the United States that heavily impacted African-American women. Also, his signing of the crime bill during the mid-1990s as well resulted in the escalation of the prison industrial complex in the U.S. It was already well underway during the Reagan years and the one term of George W. Bush Sr. But during the Clinton administration, this continued, putting more police on the street, the building of private prisons, the expansion of the prison industrial complex. Another factor also was the deregulation, the further deregulation of the financial industry, which on the surface at the time may have appeared to have been progressive from the standpoint that you had these first home buyer programs, refinancing programs. Nonetheless, these programs strengthen the authority of the financial institutions, the banks, and other investment firms, and resulted in a lot of African Americans losing the only real wealth they had, which was their homes. Here in the state of Michigan, we saw that very, very vividly because in Detroit, for example, we had the highest home ownership rate among African Americans and working people in general of any other city in the United States. That has been reversed as a result of predatory lending, which targeted, where the banks actually targeted cities like Detroit and Flint and others in order to maximize their profits. And that was initiated under the Clinton administration. The Bush administration inherited this, but they did not address it either. And when the Obama administration came in, the bailout of the banks was well underway, and they did nothing to reverse that process to actually bail out the people, not the banks. So I think Sanders' rhetoric resonates among a lot of young people, among a lot of working people, among a lot of nationally oppressed people. And we've seen that particularly in elections yesterday in Wisconsin, where Sanders won by a substantial margin against Hillary Clinton. And if you think about it, it's really not surprising because Wisconsin has over a century history of social democracy going back to the early part of the 20th century. That has been, of course, eroded as a result of Scott Walker and the restructuring of the politics and the economy of the United States. But I think it's very, very important to note that we have people in areas like Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, Michigan, and Wisconsin that are voting overwhelmingly in support of, at least rhetorically, a social democratic political program.
You know, I want to delve into the history a little bit and sort of unpack some things. The history of the Democratic Party was, you know, it was the party of not just Strom Thurmond, but also of George Wallace and of Lester Maddox and Jesse Helm. Then you had the, and that was true, really, since the period after the Civil War until there was a few blips during FDR's, black voters came over to FDR. But and some stayed with Harry Truman. Truman made moves towards that. But in the South, where the Democratic Party had control, they wouldn't let black folks even vote. They were stringing people up for trying to vote back then. And Kennedy's approach towards King and the black voters in the South was one of the turning points. Of course, the signing of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act by Johnson, a major point, and then Nixon's Southern Strategy in '68, which placed the Republican Party where the Dixiecrats used to be. But, aside from that, there's an ideological continuity both inside the Democratic Party that can be seen in terms of policies and also one with Hillary Clinton that kind of dovetails with that. You want to maybe unpack some of that?
I believe that the Democratic Party ultimately provides no substantial alternative to the aspirations of the African-American people and other nationally oppressed groups and working class people overall in the United States. What we saw under the Kennedy administration, which lasted for 3 years, three or more years, was a stalling of the whole process towards the realization of civil rights. And he got a lot of criticism, even from the civil rights movement itself, particularly people like Malcolm X, who was more or less outside the civil rights movement but had an impact on it, that you had the rhetoric, but there was not the program. And it came from the bottom, from the African-American masses themselves, through their mass demonstrations, through their political agitation, through their propaganda, which was able to shift the balance of forces in favor of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But at the same time, it didn't solve the fundamental issues and the contradictions within U.S. society, because even after those bills were passed, you had the largest outbreak of political violence initiated by African Americans since the Civil War. Through the urban rebellions in New York, in various areas of New Jersey, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in Detroit, in Washington, D.C. So these were struggles that could not adequately be addressed through the existing political structures, through electoral politics, through the election of African Americans to office, and also through the initiation, at least during the 60s and 70s and 80s, of affirmative action. But these did still not basically resolve these contradictions, because even today, African Americans have twice the, at least twice officially, the unemployment rate as the white population. And they also have lost tremendously as a result of the economic crisis of 2007, 2008. In terms of housing, jobs, pensions. We see it particularly here in the state of Michigan and the city of Detroit, where they have actually continued the exploitation of African Americans through the hijacking of municipal governing structures, the privatization of public land, the theft of pensions and healthcare programs on the part of municipal employees and retirees. So they still are exploiting the oppressed at a very, very predatory level in the United States at this time. So I think it's appropriate that people look at all these issues, because irrespective of who's elected as president in November, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's Cruz, Hillary Clinton, or Bernie Sanders, or someone else, it's still not going to resolve the class contradictions involving national oppression and class exploitation inside the United States.
Or change the ideological approach to it from the White House. One thing I noted when everybody was piling into Flint, once the water crisis there, that crime was on the front pages here, you had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and Trump and others got piling in there. Nobody stopped. Well, that's the result of this program that you were talking about, where the state house was essentially taking over the assets of the municipalities and allowing, and in coordination with certain people at the municipal level, allowing the, selling off of things like water systems and having people drink contaminated river water. There was someone there on the ground in Bell Harbor fighting that process. He's been in prison now for better than a year, and not one of them stopped to visit Reverend Pinckney.
No, he's in Marquette Prison right now. His situation is very precarious. He was framed for simply attempting to recall a mayor of a city, Benton Harbor in Berrien County, which has a long tradition of racism and national oppression and economic exploitation. It's one of the poorest communities in the state of Michigan. And he was framed for ostensibly changing five dates on a recall petition, which no one witnessed him doing. There was no evidence that he had done any of that. And he was railroaded by all white jury. And he's been in prison now for nearly a year and a half in the northern part of Michigan, 12 hours away from his family and friends. But fortunately, he has gained new friends in northern Michigan. And there's a national movement demanding an appeal of his case. And we are now organizing to go there on May the 28th to protest against the PGA senior tournaments, which are being held in Benton Harbor on Lake Michigan, demanding that Reverend Pinckney be freed and an end to the neo-colonization of majority African-American cities in the state of Michigan.
And that program has been carried out, perhaps not in as aggressive a form, but in many places in the United States, hasn't it?
It has. And they just don't publicize it. But if you look at what's going on, for example, in the state of Illinois, in Chicago, where the teachers had a one-day general strike on Friday, they are attempting to bust the existing municipal labor unions. They want to impose a system of a right to work, which means a right to work for nothing. They also want to make it appear as if people like Donald Trump and Dan Gilbert here in Detroit and Mike Ilitch somehow inherently know how to run cities and counties and state governments more so than people who live in those areas and who are elected by the voters to do so. But ultimately, there has to be an independent political direction that comes out of this whole process in 2016. As I mentioned before, the capitalist system inside the United States is in still a crisis today, and they're not going to settle for anything less than total hegemony because the system is too fragile to tolerate anything otherwise. And this is the reason why they can't even tolerate bourgeois democracy today, that people can vote on whether or not they should control their school systems, their water systems, or whether or not they want to be put out of their authority and being dictated to by Wall Street and their minions on a local level. So these are the real issues that need to be addressed. And I don't think the Democratic Party can address these issues. Even Bernie Sanders himself, even though he's running as a Democrat, is an independent. That's how he has framed himself politically within the United States Senate in Vermont. So it'll be very interesting to see how these elections pan out. It's a strong possibility he can win in Wyoming. In New York, Sanders is from New York, even though Clinton claims that's her state. But it'll be very interesting to observe the outcome of the elections in New York as well.
You know, one of the challenges that Sanders would face in terms of addressing things like the things happening in Michigan, Illinois, and elsewhere that we've been discussing is that institutionally, Democratic Party, you know, officials, the same ones that he would rely on to get out the vote in November and relies on even now during the primary, are deeply involved in such things as privatizing schools and other municipal resources.
That is definitely the case. You have a situation here in Detroit where the Democratic Party hierarchy and officials and functionaries are on board with the whole process of disempowerment of their own constituencies. And this is why they have not been able to dictate the outcome of the primaries in many states. Here in Michigan, Clinton had the support of Mike Dugan, who is the first white mayor of the city of Detroit in the last 40 years. The president of the Detroit City Council, who is African American, but goes along with the mayor and his program, and many others supported the Clinton campaign, and yet Clinton was defeated by Bernie Sanders in the state of Michigan. So this goes to show that people are starting to exercise some degree of independence on an electoral level, but that has to be transformed on a street level in order for this movement to make any type of advancements. And I think what has happened, for example, in Ferguson, what has happened around the deaths of so many African Americans throughout the United States at the hands of the police and vigilantes is also a way forward in this entire process. And ultimately, just like the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, the affirmative action, all of these gains that have been made, much of it has been made in the streets and not at the ballot box.
And finally, Professor Tony Montero has described the Trump campaign and the Sanders campaign as sitting on top of, not necessarily directing, but being the focal point of movements in each case. And out in the retail political sphere, where they acknowledge that there are these, you know, masses of disaffected people, it's almost being framed as a replay of Germany for the presidential election in 1932, and that Hillary Clinton is being presented almost as von Hindenburg, as someone necessary to stop the Hitler Trump. Do you buy into that?
It's very interesting. There's a discussion on the left now of whether or not the Trump campaign is fascist, whether Trump is fascist. Clearly, they have tapped into a political sentiment among a large segment of the white population, particularly males, who feel that they have been left out as a result of the economic crisis and other demographic and political changes inside the United States, and feel that they need to re-exert their authority inside the country. And Trump is tapping directly into those feelings. Now, some people say it's fascist. Others say it's not fascist. But if we look objectively at what has been going on inside the United States over the last decade, the working people and nationally oppressed people are being systematically disempowered as well as demonized. And in actual fact, the repressive apparatus of the state is intensifying, and it is a mass movement, so to speak. They may not wear brown shirts or black shirts. They may wear ties and white shirts. But I was involved in a demonstration outside the Republican debates in Detroit last month, and there are thousands of these people, and they feel very passionately and strongly about what they believe, that they need to, quote, take their country back, unquote. And that means moving against Muslims, Latinos, immigrants, African Americans, women, LGBTQ communities, environmentalists, whoever. They're willing to do so.
Okay, there's that part of it, but do you buy the part that Hillary Clinton should be the you know, the von Hindenburg? And bearing in mind what von Hindenburg actually did was hand Hitler the keys to the kingdom after he won to stop him.
Yeah, she definitely represents Wall Street, and she is very circumspect about her relationship with Wall Street, her relationship with the Pentagon. And with her being in office, I don't see that fundamental of a difference between her being in office and Trump being in office. Sanders being in office may turn out to be an Obama period as well. So I think that's why the left in the United States has to have its own independent position, irrespective of the outcome of the elections coming up in November.
Abby Yomius, Ikwe Pan-African Newswire, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.